There goes the scholarship, right?
I know. It's going to be a while.
We're a safe distance away, right?
You could see the comedy of this. If you knock over the lamp, then that knock over the table, then there goes a pot, and the pot hits a painting. It puts a hole in the painting.
All right.
No pressure.
We are ready. Are you ready?
Tentatively ready. This camera is rolling.
This camera is rolling.
Okay, we're rolling.
You ready?
But I'm gonna be. Matt's gonna get us all.
Hello, this is Emily Holdaway, Courtney Vollmering, and Matthew Jernstead interviewing Dr. Craig and Ambassador Barbara Barrett on February 5th, 2019 at 2 p.m. in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Wait a minute.
No, we're not.
We're not in Fountain Hills.
Oh, Paradise Valley.
Paradise Valley. Okay.
You just did that to see if we're, you're trying to test our mics.
Keeping you on your toes. Well, you're record. We'll take it out. Hello, this is Emily Holdaway, Courtney Vollmering, and Matthew Jernstead interviewing Dr. Craig and Ambassador Barbara Barrett on February 5th, 2019 at 2:31 p.m. in Paradise Valley, Arizona. This interview is part of the Barrett Oral History Project. Our goal is to preserve record of Barrett's history in honor of her 30th anniversary. So thank you, first of all, so much for taking the time to sit down with us and share your experience. We will be breaking this interview down in three chronologically arranged parts: personal history, the beginnings of Barrett and the Honors College, and the future of the college as Dr. and Ambassador Barrett see it. Emily, Courtney, and I will each ask questions from one section. We'll begin with personal history. For both of you, what were your own experiences as college students like? Can you identify any programs or perhaps services from those experiences that inspired what Barrett has become today?
Well, my personal experience was to go to Arizona State University. So yes, there's a bit of overlap, and there's something very close to what has become the honors program at ASU. When I was admitted to ASU, on the admission document that said something about honors at entrance, I noticed that, but that's the only time I ever had any impact from it, just that it was on the document. There was no program, or at least there was none that I was ever further informed about. But so there was something that got us as far as honors at entrance, but it didn't mean anything so far as classes were concerned that I ever knew subsequently. So I was at ASU, had that recognition of something called honors, but didn't know anything more about it. Though at ASU, we recognize that the honors program is something that brings a great deal of opportunity for students. So my personal experience led to us at least having an understanding of honors.
I attended another Pac-12 school, Stanford, which I believe has unfortunately beaten ASU several times in football recently. Stanford effectively didn't have an honors undergraduate program. The time I attended the university, it had about 6,000 undergraduate students, 6,000 graduate students. So 1,500 freshmen were pretty much academic achievers from the standpoint that getting into Stanford was not as difficult at that time as it is today, but someone made a mistake and let me in. The thing that I recognized mostly about undergraduate university education is that it really is a key that opens all doors, and we were both fortunate enough to be able to attend a university on basis of scholarships that others provided, and neither of us really had the financial means to attend a university without that financial help. So what we've done, perhaps in turnaround basis, is to, in our later years, when we're capable of giving something back, we've chosen to support education first and foremost for other people who were in a position like we were.
Well, continuing along this theme of the importance of education and your history with ASU in particular, Ambassador Barrett, on your profile for the Horatio Alger Association of Distinguished Americans, A quote from you reads, "Education is the key to success. It is the first major decision a young person must make and the most important." You came to Arizona for college and then made your life and career here. Can you share with us why you chose ASU, first of all, and to what extent ASU fueled your extraordinary professional success?
Well, I came to ASU because my father had been a cowboy in the American West, especially in Arizona, and I wanted to see this place that he had spoken so highly of. He had said, when you kids get old enough, I want to take you to Arizona. He died before he could do that, but I thought, well, there's a way I can see Arizona and at the same time get that college education he knew was so important, though he didn't have one. So I wrote at the time, there weren't such things as online references, so I wrote to each of the three major universities, and ASU had the prettiest catalog. So I came to ASU because of the quality of the catalog, and that would be a counterpart to the quality of the website today. But I came to ASU not knowing nearly enough to make a good decision, but it was a great decision as it turned out. So it was accidental that I happened to get to ASU, but it was fortuitous in the long run. So I came to Arizona to go to Arizona State University. The impact on my life has been transformational in that it is the education that did turn the key to open doors to many opportunities in my life, and many of those have been so very rewarding, and therefore we think important to give back.
Wonderful. And also for Ambassador Barrett, your Horatio bio further states that you drove twice a week for a total of 240 miles round trip to finish your master's degree at ASU. So thinking about that, can you tell us more about that experience and the challenges you had to overcome while you were obtaining your master's?
For my master's, I was living and working in Prescott, but to finish my master's, I took a couple of night classes at ASU. So it was about 120 miles each way. So I would work the full work day in Prescott, hop in the car, drive down, try to get here before the 6:30 start time of class, or 6:40, and then finish class and hop back in the car, drive back up to Prescott, work the next day, and come back down that night. But it was important to get that master's, and that ended up being a big benefit to me in the long run. A master's in, at the time, public administration. Public administration was willing to work with me. I was looking to get as much international business experience or education as I could, and business college wasn't very flexible in their requirements, but public administration was. So I took as many business courses, geography courses, law courses, science and political science courses as I could to get that master's degree.
And for Dr. Barrett now, can you tell us about your experiences as an undergraduate that sparked your passion for technology, and more specifically, how those experiences informed your leadership at Intel?
Well, during high school, I was pretty good in math and science, but I had my sights set on becoming a forest ranger. And my senior year in high school, Mr. Crawford came to me one day, entered his class, and he said, "Greg, you're good at math. Out." And I told him I couldn't possibly afford to go to Stanford. It was exorbitantly expensive at that time. Tuition was $250 a quarter at that time, but that was a lot of money in 1957. Anyway, long story short, I filled out the application. I knew Stanford did not have a forestry department, so I needed to major in something else, and there was a place prospective major in the application form. Elbowed my good friend Tom Hessler sitting next to me. He was going to San Jose State University. I said, "Tom, what are you going to major in?" And he said, "Metallurgical engineering." I kind of said, "What's that?" And he said, "It has something to do with metals." And I said, "Okay, sounds like a pretty good major. How many L's are there in metallurgical?" So I wrote down metallurgical engineering. Turns out I got it. I was probably the only prospective freshman applying to Stanford to major in metallurgical engineering. They had an undergraduate scholarship. I received that scholarship, and I was able to attend. But not majoring in my lifelong desire of forestry, majoring in engineering. And Silicon Valley as a site or as a place, as an entity, was just starting at that time. And it was filled with technology and opportunity. And Sputnik was also just going up at that time. And so the U.S. was engaged in a hurry-up program in terms of space research. Materials were a big part of that. Metallurgical engineering became material science. And also this integrated circuit was just being established at that time. So it was a hotbed of technology, both at the national to local level. And Stanford had a pretty good engineering school, so I just got hooked on it.
Dr. And Barry, can you spell Hessler for me?
Pardon?
Hessler? How do you spell that?
H-E-S-S-L-E-R.
Perfect. Thank you.
And then for both of you, which of your many extraordinary professional accomplishments give you most pride when you reflect on it?
So I don't find myself too prideful of what I've done, but I do take a lot of joy from things that I've worked on or been a part of. I guess representing the United States of America in a foreign country really was a great joy, also a big responsibility. So I guess serving as ambassador was something that I took a great deal of joy in. The training as an astronaut I took great joy in, passing those tests, figuring out if I could pass those tests and passing them all, that mattered. But I think I found a great pleasure in being a part of making things happen in the government and not in government, working with the women aviators, pilots in the Defense Department to open the roles so that women could fly fighters and bombers, which they had previously been allowed to fly only up through tankers and transports, but not fighters and bombers. So working on projects like that, working on things that were deemed impossible and then getting them done, that's where I take a lot of joy.
Well, three things come to mind in various stages of my professional activities. One is being at Intel Corporation almost from the start, and helping to grow that company from a startup to a $50 billion company with a major presence here in Arizona as the number one semiconductor manufacturer in the world. The second thing is Barbara and I own a resort in Montana, and in 2014 that was rated the number one hotel/resort in the world. You see there's a commonality of number ones in here. And the third thing is, and over the last decade, I've been working in the charter school business, and we have a series of charter schools, 27 nationwide, 22 of them here in Arizona. And last year, our charter schools out of 25,000 public high schools were rated 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, and 14 out of 25,000. So we're kind of the number one high school educator in the United States. So those three number ones I take great pride in. And by the way, when you take pride in those things, you're really taking pride in the people that you work with and the people that accomplish it. It's not so much you're doing, but at Intel it was literally tens of thousands of people. In the charter school business, there's 1,000 teachers, administrators. So you're really taking great pride in the accomplishments of others that you're a part of.
Well, since you brought up BASIS, Dr. Barrett, I'll flip a question here, and we'll go directly into this one. So in a YouTube video titled Craig Barrett on American Public Education Reform, you stated education is the combination of talent and action. Considering this, first of all, can you tell us what fuels your passion for education?
Education is clearly the key that opens all potential doors. And if you have a quality education and passion for what you do, there's almost unlimited opportunity for you. if you don't have that education, you're much more limited. And there's been so much written about this in the press in terms of job opportunities, earning potential, everything. So education is the opportunity that every young child should get, that opportunity. Whether they take advantage of it or not, it's up to them, but the child should have that opportunity. And there are three basic fundamentals of a quality education system. And by the way, this topic has been studied for the last 60 or 70 years. There are a number of seminal reports published in the United States going back to the 1950s when people noticed that public education was slipping. They've all said exactly the same thing over that 60 or 70 year time period. Good education has the foundational pillars of great teachers who know their subject material, high expectations. You are in education, anybody who's been involved in education really knows that when a professor or teacher tells you how high to jump, you can jump that high, and if they put the bar a little higher, you struggle, but you can get a little higher. So high expectations is terribly important. And the third thing is accountability. Accountability on the student side for working hard, and education is hard work to learn the material. Hard work on the teacher or professor's side, because teaching is hard work, and hard work on the administrators who put all of this stuff together. So those three foundations, great teachers, high expectations, and accountability, have been the foundation for every study of education reform in the United States for 60 or 70 years. What's happened in 60 or 70 years? People have commissioned another study to talk about it, and they found the same thing. Great teachers, high expectations, and accountability are important. The system has been amazingly resilient to change. It is just stuck in its own format. One of the things I notice immediately, though, in my association with BASIS schools and my association with the Honors College, is the Honors College operates on those three foundational principles. Great teachers, high expectations, and accountability. And you can't succeed in education without those three things.
Can you pinpoint a moment where you realize that you could be part of the education reform movement and make a contribution to it? What specifically happened in your professional or personal life that might have inspired that?
Well, my time at Intel, we were very interested in math and science education because we're hiring the best and brightest engineers, and we wanted the supply of great engineers to be larger. And so we got involved in K-12 education, math and science, because that's the foundation behind university educations. And I was able to participate on three or four of these seminal studies that I talked about. And we always concluded the same thing, and we always wrung our hands saying, well, we're always saying to do this, but nobody ever does anything. Barbara and I were invited roughly a decade ago to visit a BASIS school. The school was just starting in Scottsdale, and I think we went and sat in an eighth grade math class and an eighth grade chemistry class. And I was literally blown away by the level of the material that was being taught in the eighth grade, the competency of the teacher, and the response and performance of the students. And I said to myself, you know, this is what we've been talking about as a country for 50 or 60 years. This is it in real live action. I want to be part of that. And so as soon as I retired from Intel, I agreed to join the board. And as would have it, I went to my first board meeting, I opened up my board book, and I saw the first action item on the board agenda was to elect me without anyone asking me to be president and CEO of this organization. And I didn't object, and so we've been doing it now for about 10 years, and I've mentioned the results before. Results are spectacular, and what we strive to do, again, is to give as many youngsters as possible the opportunity for great education, the opportunity. And we can't make them do it. We're a charter school, an alternative school. People have to come and decide they want to go to BASIS schools. But we make the opportunity available to people. And if they take advantage of it, they get absolutely the best K-12 education in the world, bar none.
One of the things that is kind of fun to see in this is that on the K-12 level at basis schools, Arizona is excelling. The top five high schools in America are here in Arizona. Out of 25,000, 1 through 5 are Arizona schools. When it comes to the college level, and we see the Honors College being rated the most, the gold standard of Honors Colleges at the university level, plus Embry-Riddle is doing a great job. Other universities, Grand Canyon, NAU, and the U of A, there is great undergraduate education here. And Thunderbird has been rated number one in the world on international management. So ASU is one of a plethora of first-rate Arizona educational institutions. We sometimes beat ourselves up about our education, but in fact, we do a great job here.
Before we continue, we're going to stop and restart these cameras. They record for about 20-something minutes, and then they will auto-shut off, so this is a way for us to make sure that we actually manage that.
Great.
All right, refresh.
Ready?
Both of you define your leadership philosophies. What attributes do you think all successful leaders ought to have, regardless of where they happen to work or what their goals might be? And Ambassador Barrett, in your case, I'd be curious to know how your time as Ambassador of Finland might have changed your thoughts on leadership, your perspective on that issue.
Well, all leaders, all quality leaders, you'll find that integrity, honesty is a key. You don't That's sort of a prerequisite going in. Without that, there is nothing. But respect for others and respect for the time of other people is really an essential also for quality leadership. But then having a passion and a goal in mind, leadership isn't productive unless there is a goal intended and a passion that goes behind it. So I'd say integrity plus respect plus a goal makes up good leadership.
I'd echo everything that Barbara just said and pull in a little bit from my engineering background. Engineering is really an education of solving problems, technical problems. And one of the first things you recognize is you can't solve a problem unless you can clearly define it. And the art of problem solving is an issue of clearly defining the problem and collecting information and having a hypothesis and testing that hypothesis to see if it works and solve the problem. So I think a problem-solving capability, and it may be very different in the technical world and in the political world or the business world, but the problems are all there. Quite often, ineffective leaders get tied up because they really have not clearly defined the problem they're trying to solve. They can't communicate the problem they're trying to solve to their subordinates and to others. So that bit of engineering training and putting a plug in, not for against business schools and lawyers and such, but the most common educational background of Fortune 500 CEOs happens to be, come on, help me out, engineering. So that problem-solving capability, I think, is key to leadership. But integrity, truthfulness, walking the walk, and being part of the solution are absolutely key to great leadership.
And are there any influential people in your life who modeled those qualities and perhaps gave you the sense that those are important for leaders to have, going back to perhaps your career as college students or in the professional world?
Well, I'd say do it as an...
Let me get this one first, okay?
Do it?
Yes. First of all, the person sitting on my left is the most important example of leadership that I've seen. Barbara has an attitude that nothing is impossible, nothing is too difficult. If you rally the resources and you spend some time thinking about it, you can accomplish a fantastic amount. She sets super high expectations for herself in every way, and so I I just had to jump in and say, I respect that, and she's the best role model that I had. Now,
need any more time?
You know, I think your question, though, probably deals with people are more influential in your life at certain periods of your life. I mean, you know, maybe have a high school teacher, you maybe have a college professor, you maybe have a supervisor at work, you maybe have someone else, you may marry a great spouse. You know, I have my math teacher in high school that I talked about earlier, I have great respect for and set me in a course. My boss at Intel, Andy Grove, was a phenomenal human being, and along with a couple of the founders of Intel, Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore, were just icons, and working for them was a tremendous experience. But, you know, when all said and done, this one has been the most influential on me.
Thank you.
Top that.
No, I just want you to keep talking.
So that's actually a wonderful transition to the final question of my section. You know, obviously, the most incredible thing about you both is your dynamic as partners, as donors to the Honors College, among other worthy initiatives. How did you two meet?
Go ahead.
How did we meet? We met on a typical July day in Phoenix, Arizona. It was 112, and hiking at that time on the mountain called Squaw Peak at the time, renamed Piestewa Peak. We were hiking at the dusk, 6 o'clock, 6:30 time frame. We were the only two people on the mountain.
Turns separately, out we're separate.
Yeah, 112 degrees clears out some of the riffraff and hiking. And Barbara was up the top first, and I came huffing and puffing up behind her, and she was sitting there admiring this gorgeous Arizona sunset, and we started to talk, and just kept talking, and then walked down the mountain together, I probably muttered something like, I really enjoy talking to with you, and maybe we can go get a drink someplace. And she says, typical engineer, look at yourself, your pair of shorts and tennis shoes and a t-shirt. And she said, but I'd like to continue to talk. And so she suggested that we go to an Alpha Beta supermarket in 44th and Camelback and go in and get a couple soft drinks and some stone fruit. There's a bank across the street at that intersection with a fountain. So we went over there and took off our shoes and dangled our feet in the fountain and talked for another 3 or 4 hours.
And ate peaches and nectarines. It's the summer and we had stone fruit, cherries, peaches, nectarines, apricots, and shared life stories.
If I may, how did you know that she was the one that you wanted to spend the rest of your life with?
It didn't take long to figure that out. her background, what she was doing, and just how she addressed issues and problems, and what she thought was important in life. And it was pretty cool.
Well, thank you both. And Emily will now begin the second part of our interview and ask about what led to your relationship with the Honors College.
First off, what led you both to make the decision to donate to ASU to make the Honors College Barrett?
It's so funny. We had no idea it was going to be the Barrett, the Honors College. We donated because we thought that the Honors mission was important. We were both involved with a variety of the colleges on campus, and we noticed that the Honors College, there were goals for each college on how much they were supposed to target for donations during a capital campaign, and the Honors College had almost none. Was very low on their goals, but we thought the Honors College is what will dictate the future reputation for Arizona State University. So we made an aggressive, for us, a stretch donation to the Honors College instead of to piecemeal to the various colleges that we were involved with. And we had no expectation it was going to be renamed. In fact, we that was not at all anything we had considered or discussed or thought. But we got a call from the then president asking when could we meet with him, when could we together meet with him and his wife. And so we found a time when I was changing planes at the airport. Craig was going to meet me at the airport, and we were going to go together to whatever our next destination was. And so I said, we're going to be at the airport together for 20 minutes while I change planes, and Craig is going to get on the same flight. So Laddie Corps and Elva Corps came to the airport. It was before TSA restricted. It came to our gate and said, the Board of Regents has voted to rename the college in our name. We were so stunned by it. We stood there and started to cry. They started to cry. KJ, one of the basketball players for the Phoenix Suns and subsequently mayor of Sacramento, came, got off a plane and saw, he knew us, and saw us all standing crying and was wondering what was going on. So just as representative, we didn't make a donation with any expectation that there would be a name change. It was completely a stunning surprise. And we were asked that if they would allow us to name the Honors College, that might help inspire others to make donations to the university, and we hope that it has. But it has been a great source of joy for us to have our name on a college that has such extraordinary students, faculty, and administration. So the joy continues beyond that tearful moment at the airport.
We were very impressed at the time. Ted Humphreys was the dean of the Honors College, and very impressed with what Dean Humphreys had done, and Laddie Corps was president at that time. Was a good friend of ours, and we were impressed that Laddie was so actively supporting the goals of the Honors College. And we made the decision, really, if we were going to have dinner with Laddie and Elva Corps at their home in South Phoenix, and we were on the way driving. It took us about 30 minutes to drive, and we had already made a smallish commitment to the Capitol campaign, and we hadn't had anything to drink, so I can't blame it on that. But but we on the way down driving, we decided, well, let's make a major gift, and let's really help out a central core part of the university insofar as the president of the university is concerned and Dean Humphreys was concerned. And I guess the last person that cried was when Laddie told Ted Humphreys, he called him in his office and told him about the donation. Ted broke down in tears. So, I mean, everybody associated with it was crying.
We were impressed with what Dean Humphrey had done and the caliber of students that were being recruited and the outcome that was being produced, the significance of the program. So, and it's just gotten better since then.
Did it take a little bit getting used to having a college named after you? Like, hey, I go to Barrett. Was that like rooted at all in your
experience? I still refer to it as the Honors College because I can't come to think of that name, which I associate with the name, mm-hmm. but it's hard still.
It's also a great motivation to behave yourself when something's named after you in a public sense.
At the naming ceremony, we said, normally you name things after people that have died, and we don't have any plans along those lines in the near future. So that's been almost 20 years now.
So what drives you to continue donating to new programs and initiatives?
Well, the Honors College has grown in the last two decades very substantially. It is truly the academic heart of the largest public university in the United States. It is the same size, student-wise, as the premier private universities in the United States. You take Stanford, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Brown, any of these schools, the Honors College is the same size as the undergraduate population of those universities with essentially the same academic standards. So it has blossomed, it has continued to improve and get better, and frankly, we get super hyped up. The two graduation ceremonies a year, the winter and the spring graduation ceremonies that we try to attend them. And especially in the winter graduation ceremony where we have time to shake the hands of each graduate and kind of, you know, have 10 seconds to, what are you going to do next, and blah, 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 and congratulations. And we're just super hyped up at the end of that by the quality of the students that we've met during the graduation program. And we obviously interface with Mark Jacobs, the current dean, quite a bit, and go to some of the poster sessions for the research projects, and are just super enthused about the quality of the education. And as Barbara pointed out, Arizona is not highly thought of education-wise in the United States, but the Honors College is clearly the number one Honors College in the United States, and is recognized by just essentially everyone with that. And so we just are thrilled with the result and continue to be thrilled by the interaction with the students and all the good things going on.
Each student that crosses that stage gives us extraordinary joy at seeing and hearing even just a snippet of what they plan next, whether they're going immediately into the workforce or going immediately into graduate school or taking a gap year. And when we hear the thesis topics that they're doing, it's really quite remarkable to see what the what these young people are accomplishing. You ask why we continue to invest. We think it's a great program, but like the world is changing, and we want to provide some opportunities for the school to change with it. And as we see honors colleges and other top universities across the country emulate what the Honors College is doing now, we have to keep moving forward in order to retain the leadership role that the Honors College has had. And we recently funded the idea of an enhanced global engagement side of the curriculum. And with that, we've worked to bring lecturers and speakers, people like Condoleezza Rice or President Vera Freiberger, the former president, the first woman president of any of the former Soviet nations, to live on campus. Vera Freiberger was president of Latvia. And we mentioned the former defense minister of Finland. Having people like that, and I've mentioned, the ones I've mentioned have all been women, I notice. But also Katie Coleman, the astronaut, friends, and to have people like that, role models like that, come on campus are a part of what we think helps to enrich the experience that a small school like the Honors College inside the mega university of Arizona State University, we're delighted to continue to fund some of those kinds of enhancements to keep the lead that the gold standard has had in the past.
And I think it's really significant that if you look at the distribution of students in the Honors College, that it's a mixture of science students, engineering students, business students, social science students. I mean, it's a great spectrum of bright, bright young people getting together. And again, when you go back to the fundamentals of a great education, you know, high standards and accountability. And that's exactly what we see at the Honors College. You know, we have absolute great confidence in the leadership of Arizona State University. And Lattie Coore, as president when we got involved with the Honors College, had a very soft spot in his heart for the Honors College and thought it was super important to ASU. Michael Crow, as soon as he arrived on the scene following Lattie's presidency, announced that he saw the Honors College as the academic heart of ASU, and that what you could have is a phenomenal academically oriented portion of the university, but not as a small isolated Ivy League school, but is embedded within a essentially 100,000 person major public university. And so we have played some role in, as Barbara mentioned, in the international opportunities and in the kind of the Washington DC outpost for ASU and such things, but we really rely on the academic professionals, Dean Jacobs and his staff, and Michael Crowe and his staff, to direct the academic operations of the Honors College. You know, we can say, you know, you might think about this, you might think about that, but we leave the direction to the professionals.
Yeah, I'd say we don't provide oversight. They do, and the Board of Regents and the President provide oversight. What we do on occasion is provide resources or provide access, but it's entirely at the option of the college to use or not any of those.
By the way, we do provide a ton of high school students because a whole lot of BASIS graduates end up going to the Honors College.
I say every student that crosses the stage and when we get the privilege of shaking their hands, that's for me a really great joy. So we love every occasion we have to have contact. We're not underfoot. We don't come over uninvited to campus, but when we are there, just meeting the students and seeing what they've achieved and will be achieving, those are great sources of joy for us.
Occasionally the poster sessions on the research projects that are carried out. I mean, they're really invigorating and a chance to talk to students one-on-one about what they're doing in a little bit more detail. But interacting with the students is the most rewarding feature.
What impact do you think Barrett has on other honors colleges throughout the nation?
It's so fun to see. We week and a half ago, I met with a number of the leaders of one of the U.S. service academies, mm-hmm. who was saying, now, how can we do some of the things that are happening at the Honors College? And so we know that some of the best engineering schools across the country have taken a look at the Honors College. We've heard from, we know that other Honors Colleges are being initiated with help from Arizonans who have paid attention to the Honors College and are looking to emulate as much as they can from the Honors College. So we see that the Honors College is providing a great deal of leadership on a national scope for universities, as ASU is as a whole. When we think about access plus excellence, that defines ASU. So access to any university capable student in our state, access to a higher education, plus excellence with that opportunity that's given by the Honors College to have very challenging, self-inflicted challenging work that the young people there are doing. So access plus excellence, it's a pretty good combination that has stood ASU and the Honors College apart from the universities across the country.
Well, you can't have this discussion without making reference to the Honors College dorm and its cafeteria. You know, I've visited literally hundreds of universities, and if I was going back to school, it is not the sort of dormitory that Stanford had when I was a freshman there, and not the cafeteria that Stanford had when I was a freshman. The living accommodations are phenomenal, and the sense of this Honors College being a cohesive unit embedded within this massive university, I think, is just speaks volumes for the opportunities for students there, but also the quality of the enjoyment and the environment that you can have there.
And that massive university isn't just massive, but it is also demonstrating excellence and innovation. It is probably the most talked about university in the United States today because of the transformation that's been taking place there on excellence and on access. So it's a very exciting time Arizona, I think, is in fact living down that old reputation of not being a place of academic excellence and proving itself worthy. It has often been said that perception lags reality. I think that Arizona's academic opportunities are now a reality of excellence, and a reputation will come along with that.
You may not know, but President Crow lives kitty corner to us, only about 75 yards from where we're sitting now, and so I get to see him driving to work and in and out. But I've been meaning to complain to him about those buses around town which say ASU number one in innovation, Stanford number two, MIT number three. So, but Barbara points out ASU has, I think, is it safe to say it's come a long way since you were an undergraduate there?
I think Laddie Coors' leadership and then Michael Crow's is sort of a 1-2 punch that every other university is envious of. It really, Laddie made it a community-wide asset, and Michael has made it a nationwide school to be emulated. So it's a pretty good 1-2 punch. You couldn't have hoped to line it up any better. So we're ever so fortunate to have had the transformational leadership of two great leaders in a row.
Okay, before we continue with that,
yeah.
Refresh.
You were testing at that time. That was pretty long. That was long.
We got to 25 minutes, and I was like, okay, we're getting really close to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I want to make sure. Cool. Okay, we're good.
Okay, perfect. So what characteristics do you think define students who thrive at their
age? Motivated, because they could get that ASU degree without the extra work of the thesis, the leadership, the extra courses, the harder courses. Any student that chooses to go to Barrett is choosing to do more work than is necessary. That's the kind of person who in the long run is going to choose to take on those insurmountable, those challenges that are deemed undoable. So I think that a student at the Honors College is going to be defined as someone who is passionate, aggressive, willing to take on more than what is required, and then willing to pursue excellence in that aspiration.
You know, I always define talent in a prospective employee or university graduate as a good education and passion for what they do. And I see in the Honors College students passion, and they're demonstrating that passion. They're a passion for educational excellence over and above, not just the minimum number of courses to get out. And when I was getting my PhD, some students did a statistical analysis of what professor should you work for to have the highest probability of getting out in the shortest period of time, independent of what thesis topic you worked on. And they made their selection on that basis. My opinion was always, show me somebody who is passionate about what they're doing, passionate about their research. And that's the person you want to hire long term. Not the person that's just interested in the fastest way out or the easiest way to get through.
How would you explain the value of a Barrett education to a prospective student?
Hey. You want to go to a number one rated academic institution with all of the accoutrements of a larger university, great teachers. They practice the foundation of a good education system, great teachers, another subject, high expectations, accountability. Do you really want to graduate with knowing a topic or a series of topics really well and having passion for what you do? Passion for what you want to learn next, passion for what you want, where you want to go next. And that opportunity is available. And just like when we do our basis schools, it's a self-selection process. students have to choose to go to a basis charter school. Students have to choose to go to the honors college. They know what it's going to entail before they get there. They know it's not going to be the easy way out, that they're going to have to work hard, but they're committed to that. They have passion for that. And so I would just tell them, hey, if you have passion for what you want to do next and passion for getting a great education, you want to be surrounded by people with equal passion, this is the place to go. If you just want to get out in 4 years, just go, want to get a degree and that's all, the easiest possible way, hey, don't do it. It's going to be hard work. There are a lot of easier ways to do that. But I think you discover going through life that the fastest, easiest way is not always the best way for you. What you really want to do is enjoy what you do, and you want to love what you're doing. You want to have passion for what you're doing. And yeah. So
before we join, this card got full, so I have to switch the card to the other one.
I was finished anyway.
Should we start again? Didn't get any of that.
What?
We didn't get any of that. Should we start again?
Oh, no. We got everything up until like the very, very end of what you were saying about passion.
You got to be passionate.
He says deadpanning.
Sounds good. I'm sorry about that.
I don't think there's another place in the country where you can get an Ivy level academic education embedded in a massive university that has all the benefits of the multiple course types and the attraction of Broadway performances and the kinds of peripheral opportunities that a massive university provides. So the combination of academic excellence within a small community embedded within the massive university and all the benefits that come from that in both courses of study and drawing power, there's not another place in the country that has that combination.
Well, and least of all, we forget. We sent my granddaughter to Stanford at $60,000 a year tuition. And I think that a honors college graduate, as far as an undergraduate education is concerned, gets the equivalent of that Stanford education at a public university price. And, you know, ASU is, the honors colleges compared to the Ivies, and essentially those are all private schools, Stanford, private school. But it's a public school, and it's affordable. And that leads us on to the next question. Well, I think, as Barbara eloquently put it earlier, that nothing is stagnant or static in life, especially education. And what we're seeing today is, especially at ASU and kind of sister universities like Purdue, which I think is a pretty innovative university compared to ASU, changes in the way education is delivered, whether it's face-to-face or online, changes in the opportunities to study at other institutions while you're part of the home institution, international study, those sort of things. So I think that ASU should continue to evolve in those fashions. And they're not always easily predictable directions that you would go in. One of the obvious predictable one is the international one, which is there's going to be more and more international cooperation in business and research, politics, as we go forward. So giving people an opportunity to to view their country from the eyes of a foreign country, I think is a magnificent part of education. I was fortunate enough to do that a couple times and with fellowships at other universities. But we have confidence in the leadership of ASU that, as demonstrated by its number one ranking in innovation, that these innovative opportunities will come forward consistently, and we would hope that the Honors College and the rest of ASU would accommodate them, accept them, mold them to fit ASU's particular personality, but continue to move forward.
I would say the biggest change in the future of the Honors College is that these extraordinary graduates are going to repay their benefits of having been there, and they are going to become advocates for the Honors College, which will make our support pale in comparison, because they're going to be giving back and they're going to help to resource the drive for those new, to meet those new needs that will occur as time, as the world changes. And so the biggest change will be that alum will be playing a bigger and bigger role in assisting the Honors College to meet future needs.
That's a standard question, not facing the Honors College, but facing all higher ed choices going forward. One of the things I think is very positive is that ASU, I think, has done a very, very good job despite decreasing state support in terms of providing an affordable education. Certainly, any tuition can be deemed unaffordable by the lowest economic class. And I think the university, in my opinion, has been committed to provide tuition scholarships and opportunity to students who are financially hurting to attend. So I can applaud what President Crowe has done in that respect. I mean, just two or three days ago, I read an op-ed that he wrote to the state asking for more support and specifically calling out for the accessibility of Arizona State. And one of the things that I think he should be absolutely applauded for is approaching the whole issue of a student body, quality student body, not determined by what small fraction of the applicants you accept, but a student body determined by how many of the applicants you can accommodate. And so I think the university is, in my opinion, has been very cognizant of that whole issue and has, in the face of the economic slowdown of a decade ago and decrease in state support, has managed pretty well. Some of us, I graduated from Stanford with a student loan of a magnificent amount, I think $1,500 at that time frame. But that was a lot of money at that time frame. And I don't think we should unnecessarily saddle students with student loans, and especially financially struggling students. And so the general trend I see, not only at ASU, but at many universities, is to use endowment, use those funds for, in fact, scholarships, such that any student who qualifies should be able to attend.
So Arizona's constitution provides that university education should be as nearly free as possible. You might balance that with the you get what you pay for line, and that you don't want to diminish the quality of the education. You want to make it accessible. So that's the big challenge of our age, is to have students get access to a great education and have that be made possible by imaginative funding. And we've seen a lot of that by both Presidents Coor and Crow. But that's going to be a continuing challenge, is how we make it accessible for students capable of doing university level work and having them have a home at Arizona State.
Ambassador Barrett, considering some of the challenges you have spoken about, can you tell us what lessons you hope young women and Barrett will draw from your experiences?
I guess the lesson I would hope for young people, especially young women, to have is the lesson of just go for it. See what you can do. Be energetic in those college years. Try diverse things. Find out what it is you really enjoy or what you really have an aptitude and a passion for. But try a lot of diverse things. I was forced to it because I had to work 5 different jobs at a time to pay for everything. But those turned out to be very beneficial realities in my life that I wouldn't have thought at the time. But even working at the bookstore ended up being something that in my later life, it was the bookstore that the FBI background checks when I was going through clearances for government jobs. They would always go to the bookstore and talk to the owner of the bookstore who I worked for. So I didn't do that by choice. I did it by necessity. But some of those things that forced me to try different things at the time were beneficial in the long run.
What legacy do you both hope to leave for future Barrett students?
Opportunity. I think that what we have helped in a small way and what President Crow and Dean Jacobs do and the rest of the staff is provide the opportunity for a wonderful education. And that wonderful education provides the follow-on opportunity to go out and do something wonderful. I would just steal a quote from one of the founders of the company that I worked for 35 years, Intel. Bob Noyce was the founder. And he had a comment which is emblazoned in the lobby of Intel's headquarters, which is, don't be encumbered by history. Go off and do something wonderful. And that's what the opportunity a good education gives you. It gives you the opportunity to don't be held back by historical trends, historical thoughts, historical perspectives, but to go out and do something new and wonderful. And a good education and love and passion for what you do gives you that opportunity. And we hope that all graduates of the Honors College appreciate that.
I couldn't say it better. I think that's exactly what we would hope our legacy would be. And our hope would be that through our support, more students get access to that opportunity.
That's beautifully put, thank you. A core value of ASU is diversity. While Barrett already supports students who are diverse in terms of race, gender, citizenship status, and socioeconomic background, how can the college continue to foster an atmosphere that is more supportive of diversity?
I think we need to just respect people for what they bring to the table, for what they do. The packaging isn't what matters. What matters is a respect for each individual and a nurturing of what's inside that package and to bring that out and develop it for greater achievement.
Totally agree.
Well, thank you guys for your participation. If you have any more thoughts to share, please feel free to reach out. And if you have any questions about this interview or the 30th Anniversary Oral History Project, please contact my esteemed Nicola Foote.
Good job.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you so much.
And we finished with how many minutes left on the...
On the third?
So 15 minutes to go.
Oh, man.
We could think of new questions.
Yeah, I think you skipped over a couple maybe, or you've good. Well done.
Could we possibly get some pictures with you guys?
It'd be a pleasure.
That was a lot of wonderful insight. Thank you both so much.
Our pleasure.
It's wonderful. wonderful to see how much you light up when you talk about education. You just light up.
It's very simply, it is the one thing that a generation is most responsible for, which is providing that opportunity to the next generation. And it only works long term if you do that. So,
well, it's got dark in here comparatively.
Yeah. It's key.
Thank you so much for all that great content. Wonderful.
Oh, thanks. It was all pretty stream of consciousness, but good questions. Good questions help to elicit insights. What kind of backdrop are you looking for? You want the painting or?
Can we possibly go in the garden?
Sure.
Is it raining?
Oh, how fun!
Did it rain?
Yeah, it's raining. It's all wet. But if it isn't raining at the moment, that will make it an even more beautiful.
And it didn't go in my pocket. It was just sitting on the couch.
Yeah, we don't want to. Nice shirt.
Thank you.
So while we're sitting up, so we, Dr. Quinn and I are hoping to put together an exhibition case for this as part of this class that we're teaching. So we'll assemble to learn how to do exhibition design and this kind of thing. So